Bob McCown, it's John Shannon. Ho, ho, ho. Happy holidays to everybody. Hope you're getting your Christmas shopping done. What do we got today, John?
Happy holidays, Bob. Yeah, we're going to talk to coaches, guys that we've touched in the last year that have jobs, are getting jobs, won awards. So we have Bruce Boudreau before he got the job in Vancouver, Nick Nurse, the coach of the Raptors, and NHL Coach of the Year, Rod Brind'Amour.
Well, hopefully we learned something from each one of them and maybe got one of them a job.
Well, at least one of them, right?
Well, yeah, we assume the other two will keep their jobs for some extended period of time. But then again, you never know with this show. So Brind'Amour, Nurse, Boudreau, this time on the Best of the Bob McCown podcast. McCown and Shannon back with you, and Bruce Boudreau joins us. We were chatting before the show began, and Gabby was bitching and complaining about all the work he's got.
How we turn that around so fast.
Well, the key thing,
Bruce, two and a half hour drive here. I got to go. Then I got to go get lunch. Then I got to go see my kid. Then I got to do the laundry, you know, all that nonsense.
But I said it lovingly.
This doesn't pay like an NHL coach, Bruce.
No, it certainly doesn't. So anytime anybody wants to give me an NHL job, I would gladly quit the other three.
Well, let's get to that. You talk to anybody?
No. I watch everything that's going on and read all the news clips? Absolutely. Do I try to stay busy? Yeah. So, but I definitely know what's going on in the NHL with all the teams, but no one's called.
Are we in a situation, in your opinion, where there are, you know, are there teams that you have an eye on right now that, I mean, obviously there are some disappointments out there, Vancouver, Montreal among them, you know, Arizona's expectations were low, but do you pay special attention?
Yeah, I think I do. I mean, just in case, you know, I mean, if it ever happened, I think it's important to watch Vancouver right now. And because if anybody ever started talking to you, you'd have to have a little bit of an idea right, of what's going on and what you think is missing and stuff. I mean, I watch Montreal, but I don't think they would go to anybody that didn't know how to speak French. So, I mean, I really find that as a Toronto boy would be something that wouldn't happen. But there's other teams that sometimes, you know, I mean, they go into spells. I thought last week, for example, that if Dallas had lost a few more in a row, that they would be crying like crazy, but they seem to have turned it around. And every week somebody's different. Like, I mean, I followed Chicago quite extensively there for a while. Obviously that situation's rectified itself. So, I mean, I hate guys losing their job, but I certainly would like to have one. So
the interesting thing, Bruce, is you've been on the other side where you've seen your team, you know, point downwards. How do you deal with your players when things are not going well? How do you communicate with them?
I mean, there's a lot of individual meetings. I remember when I was in Anaheim, we had the year before we had went to the conference championship and we lost out in seven to Chicago, but we started the next season 1-7-2. And we got shut out, I think, in those first 10 games, six times. And I mean, which is definitely not usually what happens to a team that I'm coaching, but we had a lot of individual meetings, a lot of one-on-ones were all about staying positive. And I'd be showing them analytic stuff that were close. You know, I mean, even 6 years ago, it wasn't called analytics. It was just called statistics. But I mean, we would show we're right there and to stay the course. And eventually we turned it around and ended up winning the division. Those are the things you have to do. You have to stay positive. I mean, it's like when you're winning a lot of games, you can really bring the hammer down to make sure they don't get too high. But when you're losing, you have to, you know, give them the pats on the backs and look at all the positive points, I think, that take place and to get them out of that.
So the reality is you're actually nicer when you're losing than you are when you're not.
100%. You know, I mean, when you're winning, you're trying everything to do to they're getting a little cocky and they think they're better than they are. So you've got to knock them down a peg and tell them that, listen, we haven't won anything yet. I mean, this is the way we have to do it. But when you're losing, if you keep pounding on the negative message, then, I mean, it's already they're slumping down and they would be completely in the dumpster if you did that.
You're more inclined to have individual meetings with players when the team is not playing well?
That was an instance where, Bob Murray was traveling with us all the time. So you're waiting for us, the shoe to drop. But I mean, I have a lot, just as many meetings when you're going well to try to keep them motivated to continue that, if you know what I mean. Like, I mean, like I previously said, Bob, when you're going well, you know, you sort of tend to take practice off a little bit. You don't work as hard. Things are going well, going so easy for you. And then eventually, once it starts to go downhill, it's like a runaway train. You can't stop it. So, I mean, when a guy is going really well, I really show that, hey, listen, you're going good, but here's your faults. I mean, we love what you're doing and we want you to continue what you're doing, but you got to correct these things or it will go downhill in a while.
What kinds of things are you noticing about the game today? Is it just my perception, or are teams less inclined to play offensive fire wagon hockey today than they have been?
Yeah, it's sort of frustrating. And I don't even want to call it fire wagon, because then they say you're not playing defensively as well. But I mean, the forecheck, if you've got the opportunity to forecheck, is one thing. But if not, then everybody just drops back into the neutral zone. And I don't like that kind of hockey. Personally, I don't see why you can't be very good offensively and very good defensively at the same time. But I call it pressure defense. And in other words, get in their face, but be supportive and don't get outnumbered anywhere and don't allow odd man rushes. And if you do that, you're going to have just as much success. But I agree. Like, I mean, I'll sit there and watch and the team will dump it in and they won't say they go for a change. Then they all just sit in the neutral zone in the 1-3-1 and wait for the other team to come in and dump it in. And they won't forecheck because they're ready to go into a 1-3-1 in the neutral zone. And so I think that becomes fairly boring hockey.
John, go ahead.
Finish, Bob. You're
I was going to say, can you coach against that? Can you come up with a strategy that beats the 1-3-1 where a team is laying back and just waiting for you?
I think you can. I have in the past. I mean, we've beaten the 1-3-1s, and the biggest thing when you have a 1-3-1 and you have a goaltender that can handle the puck. I mean, we used to count all the time how many goalie touches there were in a period. Mm-hmm. And we wanted to keep it down to three or less. If you could do that, then that means your dump ins are into the right areas or off the glass, or even like I would tell them to if you get the opportunity to just dump it hard right at the goalie, because he can't control it low if it's like a foot off the net on each side. But the ones when you just throw it around the boards and they get it and they give it to the D and they come out, those are the things that really abandons a forecheck. And I really was a heavy forechecking guy, and I had only one rule. I wanted the players to, you know, a lot of it is now scoring off the rush, and I'd say great. I said, but when the scoring off the rush or is when you turn pucks over at the blue line more than you get it behind the defense, then it becomes a problem. Then I have to deal with it. But you do what you want to do, but we want to make sure that the pucks get behind the defense.
How much of your philosophy changes with the personnel? And the reason I ask that is that, you know, you seem to have some level of structure. But, you know, that roster you had in Washington was much different than the one you had in Anaheim and different than you had in Minnesota.
Well, you know what? And that's a great question, John. And I thought I would have to change everything, because we were lucky in Washington. We were big and fast. In Anaheim, we were big and fast. You know, you take Perry, Getzlaff and Penner on the first line, or Maroon. I mean, that's big line, you know. But in Minnesota, there was just nothing but little Smurfs. And I started out thinking, okay, we're going to have to change everything because we don't have the dominating board game that we're going to have. But I found out that if you've got speed, you can pressure the defense and you don't have to kill them. But if you pressure the defense, they will make mistakes on their own. And so we continued that. And I think the first year we had 106 points and the second year we had 101 points. And I mean, so it worked in both situations. So, I mean, the big thing when I say pressure is not giving anybody time and space to make a play, because players will panic no matter. And I've done it on video hundreds of times where you don't have to hit the guy hard when you dump it in. But if you just pressure him, he will make a mistake.
How difficult is it? You know, you've talked about eagerness to get back in. How difficult is it, for instance, in the last couple of summers, how difficult has it been for you to get FaceTime with teams and owners?
Oh, I haven't been able to get anything, any FaceTime. I mean, I would love before people make decisions. I mean, I did FaceTime. I had an interview with Buffalo. I had an interview with Toronto. Those were the two teams.
Toronto was an assistant coach, right?
Yes. And I thought both times, like, I mean, I was talking pretty intelligently, but I think in both situations, they were looking for something else even before they talked to me. And because I got the feeling that they weren't interested in anything I had to say. And you can see that, like, from a visual, like I'm mm-hmm. looking at you, how the body language goes, how the questions go. Like, I mean, one of the people that were interviewing me, he didn't lift his head up the whole time. Like, I mean, just said he had a list of questions and he wasn't looking at me in the eye. Even if it was Zoom, you got to sort of look at the guy in the eye and see what he's all about, see what kind of passion he talks with and intelligence at the same time, I would think.
Well, I'm intrigued by that. If you're in that situation and you sense that there is not a genuine level of interest, post facto, don't you sit down and say, all right, what is it that scares them off about Bruce Boudreaux?
Well,
have you thought about it?
Well, I think in a couple of things in Toronto, I mean, the interview, I think one that my past as far as success, I think intimidated Sheldon a little bit. I mean, there was a lot of talk shows going, why would you hire him? You know, he's just there to, he'll take your job if you screw up, and because he's ready to go. And I, you know, I tried to make him well aware that I'm the most loyal little puppy dog in the world. And that's the last thing I would want to do. In Buffalo, it was different that I could just tell, like when he phoned me back, when the GM Craig? Phoned me, Craig? Yeah. Yeah, when he phoned me back, he said, you know what, we could have and should have brought you in for maybe a second and third interview, but we already knew what we were going to do. So I went, well, you know, and you can tell by the level of passion that they ask questions and the kind of questions they have. Because in both of them, I kept saying, well, man, I was waiting for the in to go after this or to go after that, and they never brought it up. And I should have brought it, mistake by me was I should have brought it up. And because I'm not really experienced in interviews, quite frankly. I mean, I interviewed for maybe five jobs in my life, and I got them like in the same day. So it was like, it was pretty easy. I mean, but these were where there was other, where they probably weren't looking for me. And so they were more difficult, and I probably didn't do as good a job on the interview as I would have liked to.
The assistant coaches thing in Toronto, you know, I mean, I don't view you as an assistant coach.
Me neither.
I view you as a head coach. But is Toronto different?
Well, it was Toronto. That was the only thing. If it was anywhere else, I wouldn't even have considered it. But the more I thought about it, the more I thought about being home, and my mom's almost 90, you know, and it would be closer to family and friends, that I thought it would be intriguing. And also the fact that they had, the perception of me was they had a really good team and that they could go somewhere. And the chance of winning a Stanley Cup, I think, is every hockey guy's dream. And it's one of the few things that I haven't attained. So that was the beauty of the whole thing. But everybody, like yourselves, said the same thing, that they didn't view me as an assistant, then that I should wait and wait for a head coaching job. But, you know, if it was say Arizona or something, I wouldn't even have thought about it. But because I was asked at one point about not like 7 years ago about being an assistant in Florida. And I just said, no, I'm not interested.
Well, I'll tell you, I got to be honest with you, Gabby, you and I have known each other a lot of years. If I was the head coach of the Toronto Maple Leafs, I don't want you as an assistant.
I wouldn't either.
No. And I mean, you know, I say that with full respect.
Yeah, I agree. And that's why I kept wondering, why are they even asking me? Why are they even asking me? Because if I was a young head coach and Sheldon was a young head coach, why would I want Bruce Boudreau to be my assistant? First of all, he's really popular with the media. He's popular in the city and he's got a pretty good track record. Why yeah. would I want that guy leaning over me? And, you know, because if the first minute we go wrong, the Toronto media is going to jump all over that. So I can understand that.
You're the sword of Damocles if you're the assistant coach, especially in a place like Toronto, you know, like, you know, and it's exactly as you said, first sign of any trouble, the story's going to come up. Well, there's the heir apparent sitting right there or standing right there beside the now head coach.
Yeah.
And I think you would feel exactly the same way if you were, you know, head coach somewhere again.
I agree. And I understood Sheldon's position. That's why I told him, I said, you'd never have a worry about me. I mean, for me trying to undermine you to take your job. It's happened the other way to me, and I know what an assistant should be, and I would have done it, but I mean, it would have been difficult. I'll be honest. And I think he made the right choice not to hire me.
You know, we were talking about it yesterday on the show with, a couple of our partners, Darren Pang and Brian Lawton, a guy you work with, is the best thing that's happening for a guy like you right now is Daryl Sutter's success.
Yeah, no, I love it. And I look at Daryl Sutter doing well and experience, and Lindy Ruff doing well. I mean, even Rick Bowness wasn't doing well, but it seems to fit the problem. And I think you can't beat experience when you have a pretty good team that is should be better than they are. And just because we don't move around the ice as fast as we used to, I still think we all got the intelligence and know what we're going to do.
How do you deal with 20 year olds versus 35 year olds?
I just think it's the 20 year olds now, they want to know everything. The whys, all everything is about the whys. Okay, you're not playing as much. Why? You're not. I'm not on the power play. How come I'm not on the power play? And you have to show the video and everything else a lot more. With the older guys, to me, I mean, they understand. They've been through the league for a lot of years, and you sit down and you just talk to them from the heart. And I think they understand when you talk to them from the heart. I mean, they don't like it when I put Mikko Koivu as the fourth line center. He didn't like it, but I sat down and I said, Meek, you know, you've just come off two bad knee injuries. You're not as fast as you used to be. You're still going to be put in every situation that I need because I trust you for defensive faceoffs, for last minute of play, need you at the end of a period. So your minutes aren't going to go down to 7 or 8. They're going to still stay at 14. And I did. I kept them at 14. But I mean, it's tough, but you got to look at them right in the eye and tell them why, because they've been stars for so long.
I want to talk about the National Hockey League in general, what you've observed, and get your observations on that. Bruce Boudreau is with us. We'll continue after these messages. It's McCowan, it's Shannon, it's the Bob McCowan Podcast. With us today is the head coach of the Toronto Raptors and the head coach of the Canadian national basketball team. Nick Nurse is with us. First of all, in the last few weeks, you got your contract extended with Canada Basketball. Congratulations on that. I assume you're pleased.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I mean, I think that it's been a rocky road for a lot of people, and rocky for getting that team organized maybe the way I wanted to, or the way we wanted to. So I wanted to get another crack at it. And I said, it's only going to be if we're going all the way through the next cycle, which is 2024 Paris. And have kind of taken that approach with the whole, organization, including the players, that if we're going to do this, we got to commit here for 3 years. And I'm looking forward to that.
Nick, how much did you learn out of Victoria?
Yeah. I learned a lot. I think that, you know, we got beat in a game, a close, tough game, ball bounced really the wrong way, big time on us twice, right? I don't know if you guys saw it or not, but
yep.
Oh, yeah.
Satoransky banks in that 18, 19 footer, totally guarded straight on. And then we had one go in and out on a wide open 12 footer. But in saying that, I believe that, you know, the Czechs deserve to win. They were big. They were experienced. They've been together forever. And just as an example, and this is certainly not an excuse. This is why I say that they deserve to win. They had 9 of 10 guys back from their 2019 fifth place finish in the World Cup. I mean, fifth in the world, ahead of the U.S., by the way. We got sixth. And they brought 9 of those 10 guys back. And I think we had one guy back from 2019. And that continuity, chemistry, experience probably caught up to us, to be honest.
Well, you had enough talent. I think you acknowledge that or would agree with that to succeed. How much of it was just what you talked about, lack of experience? I mean, playing experience as a pro, but maybe more importantly, coach, not much time together.
Yeah, we had a tough time together, right? I think, again, couple other things, if we're gonna, you know, kind of flesh it out, is, you know, they had tremendous size. They had 3, you know, near 7 footers that have been playing a long time in the Euro League. Dwight Powell was playing great. We didn't have a lot of other size, and he got in foul trouble, so we ended up playing Trey Lyles, who did a great job and kind of small. You know, one of our fears going into the game is we had to protect Dwight, and we tried to the best we could, but end up getting in foul trouble late in the game. And you're right, we didn't have the greatest prep. And it's not like we didn't want to have great prep, right? It was tough protocols. There was we weren't allowed any friendlies to get ready for it. Those teams were all playing in Europe and well before where they played us in several games. And you know, geez, even when we got to that first game against Greece, it was like, you know, they came out and kind of blew our doors off at the start like a well-oiled machine. And we had to like switch everything we were doing at half to kind of figure out a way to get into the game and eventually overtake that game. But, you know, just didn't know who I didn't know who our team was at all. You know, I had no identity. I didn't know roles. I didn't know subbing patterns. We just didn't know who we were. And those games were live and for real. So we learned a lot of stuff. To go back to your original question, we learned a lot. Yeah.
So does that mean that, I mean, you've committed, do you believe that the players, we have so many great players in the NBA now that are Canadian, do you believe they've committed?
Yeah, so here's what we did. I mean, that didn't sit very good with me coming out of Victoria. And you guys, if we've talked enough over the years, I can get over and move on pretty quickly. And in the NBA, you kind of have to, right? That one didn't sit with me very good. I've been still kind of mulling that one over. It hurt me not to get that one done. Got to work on immediately on the plan forward again. Like, you know, I just told them, you know, I mean, I think we're happy with the steps forward we took. I think we got a lot more guys than we normally got to play under difficult circumstances. Some of the things we just talked about, I don't need to go over again, but got to work right away and started calling the players and telling them, here's where I'm at. And a lot of things helped here, like the experience there, the Olympics following. You know, I was getting a lot of communication texts and calls from the players while games were going on in the Olympics about France and Australia. And, you know, and I was telling them, you know, what do you see there? And I, you know, I'm saying, this is what we've got to do. We've got to get a group of guys. It may not be the best, you know, on paper or whatever, but we need a group that's committed and wants to play and is going to play and stay together. So I started making the rounds with some of that. And I said, listen, I'm getting ready to come back, but I'm only coming back. And if it's a 3-year deal, and I need you guys to commit to 3 years and play each summer. And so we can get out and play some friendlies and we can get out and get to know each other and get something done. And they were the guys, you know, guys that were there were in and some other guys that were there. So anyway, we ended up deciding to use Vegas. You know, it's kind of a convention, basketball convention out there. Not only is it summer league, but everybody's out there. So we decided to use Vegas as a kind of a 2-night approach. The first night was we invited 15 players that we thought would make up the core for this team for the next 11 of them ended up getting on a plane and coming to Vegas and sitting down and having a dinner with us. And we basically just wanted to lay it all out. We laid out, here's the schedule. here's the commitment, the exact dates. We're going to call you to camp for the next 3 summers. Here's the NBA schedule. Here's free agency. Here's the draft. Here's all this stuff and take a look at it. And that's the commitment we're asking for. So I think it was a good start. We had 11 there. The vibe was super positive as well. I am days away from kind of getting that on paper and getting it out to them and making sure. I mean, it's one thing to be sitting there and saying, yeah, I'm in and all that kind of stuff, but we need
to. Yeah, sure.
I don't want your decision now. I want you to go away and think about it, digest it, talk to a family, your friend, everybody you need to talk to before you're in. And, you know, one of the guys said, well, what if we all say no, what are you going to do? And I said, well, we'll take the under 19 team that just finished third in the world and we'll let them play for the next 12 years together. And they'll put multiple medals around their necks in their careers. And I think we've got the talent and it's time for us to, again, it's time to build it, man. It's time to build it the right way. And we're going to stand in there with them. I believe we'll get an uptake of guys. I think of that 11, I would be surprised if it goes plus or minus one other each direction. But really? Many of the guys got up and spoke passionately about their desire to play and the commitment and getting there early and extra, you know, all those kind of things. So that was a long answer. I'll stop talking now.
No, it's an interesting threat, though. I'll take the 19-year-olds if you guys don't want to play.
It's not a threat. It's not a threat. It's just that we needed to have an answer for
sure.
You know, that was a great question. It was a great question that they, you know, one of them posed is like, you know, this was well before this dinner. And one of them said, well, what if you know, coach, I'm in, but what if nobody else wants to be in? And then I'm saying, well, then we're going to have to go with what we think's best to build it. And I think that these guys are, I mean, I don't know. We built it up, I think, and we've got them, you know, we're doing things first class. We've got a great coaching staff. I really believe in the guys running it, you know, all this stuff. I think there's some, you know, that thing in Victoria, too bad it was COVID time because that was getting ready to be a kind of, you know, knock your socks off event. You know, that thing would have been sold out and the festival and all the things they were going to do there. So I think there's some really positives and now we just got to get the team on a little bit more of a schedule. Let's put it.
Hey, before we talk about your other team, because I know Bob's chomping at the bit about that. Looking at your history, looking at your career, there really is a love of international basketball, isn't there?
Yeah, 100%. It's awesome. It's awesome. And I, you know, I kind of fell into it I went over originally as like a 26-year-old just to get a lot of head coaching experience that I thought I could get in over there. And then it's just like, you know, like a lot of things, you move in circles, right? Well, I was in that circle. And if there was a Euro League in Paris, I would fly to, you know, I'd go watch it. Or if there was a summer league in Treviso, Italy, I'd be there coaching it. Or I kind of got in that circle. And then obviously had the experience with both the English team way back when, and then the Great Britain team going into 2012 as an assistant. It's such a different and such an interesting and passionate game at that level. It's really cool.
As John mentioned, we do want to speak about your other team, but before we do that, do you have any trouble compartmentalizing your thought patterns between the Raptors and now international basketball? Or do you kind of put it in a box and you're focused on this and then when that's over, you move to that?
Well, I don't think so. I think they're kind of, they're probably more intertwined than I think they're intertwined. I don't know how anybody feels about it, but listen, I came out of that Victoria thing thinking, man, I tell you what, we got to have this and this in place for this national team. And started toying with some different defensive thoughts and that. And well, I took them to the next Raptor training camp and we tried some of them in summer league, and it ends up looking like they're going to look really good in the Raptors organization, you know? So it's, you know, I think you're kind of mixing and matching. And I think intertwined is the way it's basketball. It is very different settings and all that stuff, but there is still a lot of common threads there.
Nick Nurse is with us. We'll take the break, come back with more after these messages. Bob McCown, John Shannon with you, and the head coach of the Raptors, Nick Nurse, is along with us.
He's the only guy that has the only guy that has his own hat, though, Bob. I mean, you don't have your own hat.
That's not true. There are about six guys in this building that have the Freddie Van Fleet, Pascal.
No, but I every time I see you with your hat on, I think, man, oh man, to have your own hat, that's cool, man.
Yeah, thanks. It was a total accident, but thanks. I kind of like it. Especially in the summertime, I don't have time to, you know, get to my hair very, very often. So there you go.
Scotty Barnes, a somewhat surprising first round pick from a lot of people, a worthy pick, and you've now had a chance to see him play in summer league, and he's pretty impressive, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I agree with you. Let's cover the surprising pick first. I think that. First of all, Suggs is really good and looked good in summer league. And I think he's going to be a hell of a player without doubt. I just think that Scotty for us was a different position, different size. I thought we liked his length. You don't know. He's really young. He just turned 20. And he's got great energy. He's a willing player. He loves playing defense, you know, so that's good. You know, he wants to play both ends. And I think that you're right. I thought he looked really, really good, really interesting this summer.
Well, Nick, in picking him over Suggs, what would your role have been? How much input would you have had with Bobby and Masai and the scouts?
Well, the bad news is I was supposed to be in Tokyo coaching the national team, but the good news was I was down there every day in the workouts in Tampa, getting a look at them. Really interesting process, fantastic job that our front office did. It's really a high level thing watching all that take place leading into that. So you know, just kind of when you bring them in, they got kind of a rhythm to the way it goes. Obviously, I get a one-on-one meeting with the player and get to go to dinner with them at night and obviously watch them work out and watch some film with them, all kinds of stuff, and try to get to know them, you know, the best you can and figure out who they are in a one day or day and a half type scenario.
You don't have to be specific about this, but I think a lot of people are intrigued by the process of sitting in the room and the decisions are not necessarily made minutes before the Toronto Raptors are called by the commissioner, you know, you're on the clock. That decision most often I would think is made a long time before, but tell us whatever you will tell us about the process of making a decision. I mean, was it Suggs or Barnes, or was it Barnes long before you even got involved when you were still in Victoria?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think, Bob, you've been probably around enough drafts and multiple sports to know that your team of people puts together, you know, their list, you know, just literally you got to list them and then it does come down to kind of minutes before, because you really don't know what's going to happen beforehand, right? I mean, there's always the chance that something happens to change that, or somebody you had higher still sitting there or whatever. I think that's always kind of the way you gotta go. I mean, it did unfold pretty predictably in 1-2-3, and Scotty we had ready to go there as our first pick if those three guys did go in that order. But there's still a lot of wondering, waiting until those picks are actually made. Yeah.
It's McCallum. It's Shannon on the program for this day. And with us, the head coach of the Carolina Hurricanes, the Jack Adams Award winner, former Stanley Cup champion, Rod Brind'Amour is with us. Well, first of all, quite an interesting last few days for you, renewing your contract for the next 3 years with the Hurricanes and the winner of the Jack Adams. Congratulations. Quite an accomplishment.
Well, it's like I said, you know, when it happened, it's an organizational award, right? I mean, there's no coach that can take this award and go, oh, hey, look what I've done. I mean, if you don't have the horses, number one, you're not winning it. Let's just be fair. And then you got to have good people around you. And that's what I'm really lucky to have. So it's good to be recognized, but it's, you know, I think even better for the organization.
So Rod, the contract was announced on the 17th. By coincidence, you wore number 17 for so many years. But truthfully, when was the deal done?
You know what? No, that's a good question. The deal would have been done in about 3 minutes with Don and I. We had it figured out in January. I said, okay, here's the numbers. This is it. He was like, okay, yep, that's pretty fair, and you know, we'll move on. But I said it. You know, there were some contingencies. You know, I said we got to get all these other people around done. And unfortunately we had 10 people downstairs work with me that their contracts were up too. And that's what the holdup was. It just takes time to get all those people kind of figured out. And for the most part, we got everybody done. So that's what happened.
Does that include Dean?
Well, Dean's the one guy that's kind of hanging out there, you know, and he's welcome to come back. He's just trying to see if he can, you know, see what else he can get. And I'm okay with that. He's got to do what's right for his family first and foremost. And, but he knows that he's welcome back. So that's kind of a little trial period for him.
I'm not sure if you're aware, but Tom Dundon, the owner of the franchise, was on with us, John, a couple of weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, maybe.
Maybe six weeks.
Oh, was it that long?
Yeah.
And we talked to him extensively about, you know, your situation, your contract. And he was very clear. He said he didn't want to own the franchise if Rod Brind'Amour wasn't the head coach. So you got a friend and an ally there for sure.
Tom's been great. Listen, he takes a lot of heat, which is I think it's because he's new to it. And, you know, he's not backing down from what he wants to do and how he wants to do things. And yet, you know, I don't know an owner that does more for his team than this guy. As far as he is involved in everything, you know, from you name it, from the smallest thing to the biggest thing, from players. And from day one, he said, hey, look, I'm going to give you a fair fight. And that is, we're going to spend the same amount of money everybody else is spending on players, which is something you can't say was done here, you know, for many, many years. Trust me, I was a player here. I line up and look across the way and be like, this is not a fair fight tonight, but we got to figure out how to win. And he's saying, we're going to take that element out of it. And now you just got to go coach him up. And, you know, I think a lot can be said for that.
Well, he's a fan of yours and he's a fan of the game, but is he a hands-on owner? You would know better than anybody.
Oh, yeah, he's on everything. And that's, and some people think that's like, oh, that's a bad thing. And I actually think it's the opposite, because when we say, hey, you know, this player's got to go and he's like, okay, you know, or we want to get these players, like we're in the conversation at least with all this stuff. And he listens, right? Like he has his opinions and he'll throw them at me and Don, and he throws it all the time. Every day he's testing us on things that I don't know that he believes it. He's just throwing it to see if it sticks. But you know what, if we can tell him it doesn't or show him it does, you know, he's all about getting better. And that's, at the end of the day, that's all you can ask.
How would you describe your coaching style?
That's a better question for the guys I probably coach, but I think I just try to be myself. You know, I just try to be honest as I can be. I mean, there are things you can't be so honest. I've learned, you know, you got to sugarcoat it a little bit, but really at the end of the day, just be yourself. I mean, there's no way I could do this job if I was trying to be, you know, someone else or a different coaching style or whatever. You learn from everyone you're around. You guys know that. And then you just got to go out and trust your instincts.
So I ask coaches all this all the time. When you say something behind a bench, is there somebody you hear? Is there somebody in the back of the mind says, oh my God, I sound like Bill Dineen or I sound like somebody. Is there somebody that comes to mind for you?
I don't think so. I would hope not, you know, I mean, I hope it would be, that's me speaking, but I know there's everything that I probably do is come from somewhere, you know, someone, I mean, I got, you know, even this Jack Adams Award was great. Brian Sutter was the guy that presented it, you know, and I just think back to him when I was a kid, really, he coached me as a kid, and the stuff that I realized how much I've taken from even that couple of years with him, you know, transforming as a player, but am I still using that as a coach? Probably, you know, and there's, and a lot that I wouldn't be doing, right? Like there's, you know, the times have changed. And so, again, you through all experience, you take the good and the bad.
Well, Rod, I was going to ask you sort of the same question John asked, but let me rephrase it a little bit. So you're not a duplication of anybody that coached you. You don't think about that. But the best coach and your favorite coach can be two different people. In fact, quite often it is. Who is your favorite? Who is the guy you were closest to?
Well, that's a good question. When I played, it wasn't all that long ago, but man, the years go by quick.
Yeah, sure.
You didn't have relationships with the coaches. You know, like the year we won the Stanley Cup in 2006, I went into the Peter Laviolette's office twice the whole year and had two conversations with him the whole year. I actually, when I took the job as an assistant coach, I didn't even know what the coach's offices looked like in the back, because I'd never been down there in 10 years that I've been at that rate, because we just didn't, it's not how it worked. And now all the players know what everything, like they're down there, they run the show, right? So it's a total transformation. But the guy I probably enjoyed the most was only for a year, and you mentioned him, I think John, was Bill Dineen. Just, I mean, you couldn't have it any better as a player. I'll just leave it at that. I mean, it was like your dad coaching you. And, you know, we had Kevin Dineen on the team, so his dad was the coach, but he treated us all like his kids. And so when it was good, he was good. When it was bad, he was hard on his kids, but in a totally weird, loving way, if that makes any sense. Like, it just never felt personal. It was always trying to help you. And that was pretty special.
So I have been around the NHL longer than you have, which means now I'm really old. But I used to hear about you, particularly in St. Louis as a player, that you were really hard on yourself. You beat yourself up if you didn't play well. What changed, and do you beat yourself up as a coach?
It's a great question, because we got a kid in our lineup now. This is going to be a star, that's Svechnikov. And he reminds me of myself in the way he handles things that don't go well. You know, he's hard on himself. And so now I'm sitting in the coach's seat, and I'm like, man, I'm, you know, Bill Dineen now. Cause he would say, kid, you got to relax. And I'd be sitting there going, how do you say relax? But it's true. Now that I've gone through it, so now I'm trying to think, how do I get this coach talk through to this kid with him not to think it's, you know, what I did back when I was a kid. Oh, come on. He doesn't know what he's talking about. Right. Like, because it's important. I mean, that's just from experience. Right. So it all, I guess you learn from all of it as you're going along. And I already forgot your question.
Well, no, just how hard, I mean, you were so hard on yourself as a player.
Yeah. Am I hard as a coach? Yes. And I actually did an interview not too long ago with the great coach from Duke, Coach K, and on his show. And I asked him, like, how do you do this? Like, not just, you know, eat yourself up over and over. Like, cause when you win, you're supposed to win. So it's like, okay, how are you supposed to be that excited? You were supposed to win that game. And then when you lose, it's like twice as, you know, that was all your fault, right? Like, that's how you feel as a coach. Or, and I always say, when I played, you worried about your mistakes after the game. When you're a coach, you worry about the 20 guys' mistakes because they're all yours. So it's not a very fun job when you do it that way. And he was his great comment was, you can't have a rear view mirror. Like, you always got to be looking ahead. And then I joked with him, well, he never loses. So it's a little different, right? When you just can win every night. But I think I'm hard on myself, which, you know, I think you almost have to be, though, to keep pushing, moving forward.
Well, yeah, you made a valid statement. I mean, when you look at Krzyzewski and his record, and okay, granted, it's college basketball. He's a Duke, and, you know.
Well, you only have the guys for 2 years. Rod could have a guy for 10.
Well, I acknowledge it's different, John, but I mean, the truth of the matter is that if Coach K lost one game in a year, he probably was disappointed. You know, you can't say that in professional sports, and certainly not in the National Hockey League with 82 game schedule. Rod Brindamore is with us. How do you find over the years that you've now done this job, have the players changed dramatically? Do you talk to them differently today than you did when you first started? Because we hear all the time about the difference between, you know, when John and I were kids, you know, before you were born, and how coaches ruled the roost and what the coach said goes. Mm-hmm. Well, you've gone through kind of an evolution of when you were a kid, the coach was what he said went. But now it's more of a partnership, isn't it?
Totally. Totally. And if you don't think it's that way, you're not going to survive. I think, I don't know how you can coach the way it was coached back when we did. It won't work because these kids have never seen any of it. You know, they won't even understand what's happening. And so you got to adapt with it. I think what's helped me is never stepping away from the game. So even when I stopped playing, I was right into the coaching on the assistant side. So I'm always involved. And then having kids of my own, to be honest with you, at that age, going through it, I feel like I can relate to where they're coming from. And so that's helped. But yeah, you've got to adapt with the times for sure. And how has it changed? The athletes today are way better. Like, they just keep getting better and better. They take care of themselves way better. They've owned skills coaches and diet. Like, they have everything figured out, right? They got all these people helping them to be better. Makes them better. It also makes them worse too. And sometimes they're so reliant on everybody else to tell them, get that feedback. And sometimes it's not good feedback. Sometimes just shut up and go do your job. You know, like, it's all you got to do. But they're always looking for the anchor, you know, if that makes any sense, instead of just, let's just focus on you being the best you can be. You don't need to have this validation all over the place. So there is a little bit of where, as a coach, I'm trying to instill that. And I know in the background, they've got three guys telling them something else. You know, so there is all that you have to kind of, I guess, deal with. But the athletes are so much better because they are 24/7 now.
How do you, actually, that's a really good point, because I've heard other coaches say, you know, players have, he has his own shooting coach, his own stick handling coach. And he's telling the guy different things than you're supposed to be telling him. How do you manage that?
Exactly. Well, they all say that they're not. See, there's the key, John. They all go, well, no. Their guy's not telling them to do it differently. They're just, I'm like, please, just let's cut that out. We know he's, you know, we had a guy, and I won't mention his name, he's no longer with us, but he had his own guy that would break down shifts that he would send his shifts to. And then he would tell him, I say, that's what where our job is. I got three assistant coaches that are sitting here willing to work with you, go through your shifts. Oh yeah, but you know, and then like, where are you going with this? Like, yeah, this is not going to be helpful. Right. But they all got, you have to figure it out. Now, we got him out of there because we knew that wasn't going to work, you know, but this is what is going on today. And I guess you take the good and the bad, and the good ones get it. The good ones, I don't think, have three people working for them, but they're dialed in.
Well, let me get a little more basic than that. When you're a kid, coach says, this is how you do it. And you learn, the older you get, the less instruction you get, I suppose. But now, when you get to the National Hockey League, how much teaching do you actually do?
That is an unbelievable good question. Simple. But if you really break it down, once you're at this level, how much coaching do you need is the one question. And I, as far as getting from point A to B, am I going to make you a better skater at 19 years old than you are now? We can work on it until we're blue in the face. And there'll be skate coaches on here that tell you, oh, yeah, I can. Okay, maybe. Maybe a little better, you know, if we put in the time. I'll just tell you, I'll give you the ice time. We'll spend 20 more minutes after practice working on skating. I'll get you to be a better skater. But, you know, it's, I don't know how much teaching you can do on your skills and what you already have. You are who you are for the most part. You'll get stronger just naturally if you're 19. By the time you're 22, you're in the gym, and that'll help your skating. But to actually improve on it, you know, I don't know how much better you're going to get. So how much teaching goes on? The teaching happens on how to play the game away from the puck. That to me is where all the teaching comes in. We don't teach Andrei Svechnikov what to do with the puck. And I'll tell you right now, very rarely. I mean, I'll tell him sometimes, hang on to it more, you know, but I'm not telling him what to do with it. Not telling Netcash, how to shoot the puck. The guy knows how to shoot the puck. He's better than anyone I've seen. So we're not going to work on that. But I guess what? They need a ton of work on when they don't have the puck. And that's all the kids coming in. They need that more than ever, especially the younger kids that were really elite. Elite players coming out of junior hockey, I find they play with the puck their whole life.
Right.
They never had to play without it. Now they get the NHL and it's 90% of the time they don't have it. That's a problem. So that's where the teaching comes in, I think, at our level.
So there you go. Some of the best of the Bob McCowan podcast from the past 12 months as we take a little vacation here, to the chagrin of the audience, I'm sure.
Well, not much of a vacation when you think of what's going on in the world, Bob. But you know what? It's a good time to spend your family. Good time to have some quiet time, enjoy some eggnog and some festive spirit.
Happy holidays to y'all from John and I. And we'll see you in the first week of January. Goodbye, everybody.